I'm speaking today with Councilmember Jack Christie, who is the incumbent in at-large number 5. Councilman, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. You're serving in your first term on City Council. Has it been what you thought it would be when you first ran for the office?
Sure is. I haven't had a bad day yet. It's really challenging, but satisfying, because the city's in a good direction.
Okay. Now, before you ran for council, you had served on the State Board of Education and on the Spring Branch Independent School District Board of Trustees. How is council like or not like either of those two bodies?
It's a lot of similarities, because it's about building bridges between your members, between the executive director, and doing what's right for, in the case of school boards or state board, doing right for 4.2 million public school students. Here it's doing what's right for 2.1 million taxpayers. But you have a chief executive officer as the mayor, the commissioner of education on the state board. So to move things forward in a positive direction, you have to get along with everybody. And if you don't vote your direction, as long as you have a majority of votes, you can do some good in city council.
I often hear from people who've been on city council that it takes a little while to get up to speed, just learn everything about what's going on with city government, get used to the job. And you've been on council now for about a year and a half. How far along on the learning curve do you think you are, and what have you been working on that you're proud of?
Well, I think I did homework before, so if you do advanced work, you can hit the ground running. And again, it's about building relationships and trust that you can get things done. And then if you do your homework on each city council meeting, then you're up to snuff on what the ordinance is or what the budget is. And I've been known to do good homework. That's for sure. And I do it as a full-time job. I still see a few patients, but mostly I put in 40, 50 hours a week with the city. When you asked what are my priorities or most proud of, financially we have two major areas that we have to tackle. We can't kick the can down the road. It's medical costs or retirees' costs and pensions. And I've just been working with both groups to bring that down with some common sense measures. And but when it comes to money, people fight for every dollar. And if you've got two unsustainable areas, somehow you've got to get it under control.
Let's talk about healthcare costs, because that's something that is, of course, a big concern. Doesn't tend to get as much attention as some other items in the budget. What do you see? Where is the city as far as that goes? What shape is the city in terms of controlling its healthcare costs? And what opportunities do you see to do things that can help with that?
Well, you're seeing the problem on a city, state, and federal level. For years, they've been saying on CNN, the PhDs, the economic professors, that Medicare will bankrupt this country. Medicaid will bankrupt the state and federal government. And local costs, it's out of control. I mean, all the way from Exxon to General Motors, they just have challenges in controlling costs. No country in the world spends what we spend. And we, the last rankings, we were 37th in industrialized countries in health. We can keep saying we have great health care, we have good disease care, but this country does not take care of itself, its health. In my profession, the work I do, I've been in prevention for 40 years, and so understand, if you take care of the human body and not just be over-medicated and cut on at every chance, you'll stay healthy. But this is the most over-medicated, the most cut-on society in the face of this earth, and we're not healthier. So I think some of the ideas that I go back to making suggestions to Governor Ann Richards on 10 ways to cut health care costs. It's really disease care costs. And, you know, they were just kind of overlooked, but maybe they were 20 years before their time. But now, some of the suggestions that I've made, the HR department has implemented some of them, and it's really, for the first time, going in a health-oriented direction instead of waiting for disease. And if you look at Consumer Reports last month, if you look at some of the national headlines the past few days, they're saying, maybe we shouldn't overtreat. Maybe we shouldn't be so aggressive and say, you're going to die from this the first day. And then work with the body and healing itself. And so that's the direction I've been pushing for decades, actually. But someday it has to. Prevention doesn't make a lot of money. So sometimes I cynically say, follow the money. You know, you'll get a new invention and they'll charge $1 billion for it, and patient won't be any healthier. One congressman asked a couple of years ago, 75 million MRIs done in this country last year, and not one patient feels better. You know, so follow the money. Just prevention doesn't really cost. Eating right, exercising, resting properly, quit smoking.
So how does this translate to a policy level for the city's perspective?
We're right in the middle of it right now, because in 2015, our portion of the disease care budget is going to be $350 million. And so that's unsustainable, just like portions of the pension. It's unsustainable. We can't continue in that direction. So I've pushed, and we're getting some good feedback from some of these hospital systems that say, I tell you what, you give us $270 million and we will keep your 55,000 employees and dependents and retirees well. Isn't that a novel idea? That you pay for wellness. So they get $270 million. We save $80 million. We can't afford $350 million. So the incentive has to be health and not disease. And I think from the baby boomers on down, they realize that you can't just cover it up with pills and cut it out with a knife. You have to maintain health, and it costs less. But if you let the money mongers, the medical industrial complex, run it, you're going to pay more every year. Some of these drugs that they're charging, there was one on the national TV where one insurance company okayed this drug and one didn't. And they said, what does a drug cost? It was a cystic fibrosis case, which there's no real cure for that. $25,000 a month. Gold doesn't cost that much. So we have to say, no, we better take care of ourselves. We can't afford $25,000 a month.
Well, you talk a lot about prevention, and I certainly agree that that's a good approach. There was a bit of a controversy a few months ago on council regarding paying for a vaccination program that you voted against.
Right.
What was up with that?
Well, just look at that. And that's a perfect example of the drug industry puts fear into people that this flu vaccine, or this flu this season, will wipe out the face of the earth. And the fear goes in there. They get the news people, you got to get your flu shot, you got to get your flu shot. Then after the season is finished, like the previous swine flu, well, it really didn't take hold and you needed a follow-up and we really didn't have any more cases than the regular flu. And so I just said at one point, you know, you don't die from the flu. I changed it to, you shouldn't die from the flu. But they'll take one case and just say, see, if this person had the flu shot, they wouldn't have died. Well, you check back and see the treatment schedule of that individual. That individual caught a staph infection in a hospital and died from a staph infection, not a flu. So in the efficacy of the vaccines, it's always questionable. And I've got three patients that I'll show you where it was devastating, the side effects to their neurological system. And then I'll show you a clip from one of the major stations where the medical director said to the audience, "Oh no, the flu shot gave my son the flu." That's a direct quote. And all the national media said, "Oh no, can't give you the flu." But it can.
Okay. Let's talk about pension then. As you know, the main point of controversy, or contention, I should say, is with the firefighters' pension.
Yes, sir.
The city, Mayor Parker, has been trying to get the legislature to pass a bill that would require firefighters to meet and confer with the city over pension fund and how much the city contributes. So far, the legislature hasn't taken that up. Do you support that effort to require meet and confer?
I think I would go about it in a different way. And I got permission from the mayor to ask the firefighters to come by, and they all came by. And I just ask for a change, like a change in cost of living increases. Do you know that just some of the cost of living increases would turn it around? And they were very polite, and I go to every one of their events and fundraisers, and we got great firefighters, but we need some help. And I'd rather see, instead of a stick, that we use a carrot. And so actually I'm meeting with them an hour later from now, and I know they'll ask me about that. And I just have to say, I need some help. And in that first meeting, I said, no, if I were a firefighter, I would have put my lockbox somewhere else if I could, protect it in Austin, because you have a lot of rural support. You have a lot of, a lot of state reps that are not in the city of Houston, and firefighters are very popular. But, so I would rather work with them over time and use more of a carrot. And because you know, if it gets to a certain level and the revenues are just great, you reinstate that reduced COLA. But the real world, business world, they can't guarantee pensions like this. Look at Detroit. I mean, look at American Airlines. At some point, it's unsustainable. And so those two areas of the budget, we've got to turn around the unsustainable portion. But no, I would not go for I don't need meet and confer. If they'll voluntarily just meet and confer with me on a person-to-person basis. So I'd rather try it that way first instead of a stick and beating them over the head.
Okay. Quality of life issues have been fairly predominant this past couple of years on council. And as you know, council recently approved some changes to Chapter 42, the development ordinances that talk about things like density and other requirements for what developers can do. It seems like there's been a lot of flare-ups in different neighborhoods, in the Heights, in over where the Ashby High-Rise is, now in near River Oaks, where developers are proposing to build, multi-story, multi-unit buildings in areas that predominantly have single-family homes, and the residents are not happy about it, but they tend to find that they can't do much about it. What, if anything, do you think the city should do to address the concerns of neighborhoods that, you know, would like to be able to exercise more control over what gets built in their neighborhoods?
A city with no zoning, and you can debate that, and it has been debated for decades, there's only so much you can do if you can't control zoning. And freedom of zoning has great benefits. But what the city has done, especially with residential neighborhoods, it allows their deed restrictions to prioritize. It allows even a period of time, of 1 or 2 years, to even tighten up deed restrictions in neighborhoods to where let them decide density. And they're always consulted before major ordinances like Chapter 42, and that was almost a year in the making, if not more. And so the neighborhoods do have a priority with the mayor and most of city council. But it's unfortunate. You are the house next door to that high rise that goes up. You know, the only thing the city can do is on permitting and traffic and quality of life there, as far as the neighborhood's concerned. And always listen to, but there is a certain point where we have no jurisdiction if there's no zoning.
Houston, as you know, has gained a reputation as being a very good city for food. We have a great restaurant scene. One of the things that's been helping this image is we have a pretty dynamic food truck establishment, and food trucks organization recently came to City Council to inquire about their ability to operate downtown. Right now, they're restricted from operating downtown, you know, in the ways that they can operate elsewhere in the city. You were one of the council members that expressed some concern about this, so I'd like to know, where do you stand now on the issue of food trucks being able to operate downtown?
Okay, I'm strongly in favor of it, and I think the future it will be loosened more and more. There's just fear was put in there about propane tanks, and that's kind of ridiculous. Quality of food is really superior to where the food trucks are. Great additions to the nutrition of the city. They're convenient. You know, I just don't want them setting up a bunch of chairs and be almost a permanent fixture for a set period of time that hurts the brick and mortar. But I don't think in any rules and regulations now that the brick and mortar is going to be hurt. So I'm going to be encouraging the better use of food trucks. I've been in New York and Boston, and God, it was just superior food. So I'm a big fan of that. The only concern I had way back when, it was kind of misinterpreted, that there are instances where other things are sold in the truck. And you just don't want to set up boutiques and jewelry stores within a food truck. And that was my only concern, but it was misinterpreted that I thought that there was illegal stuff sold in the trucks, and that was no intention of mine. I don't want to turn it into a hamburger and boutique moving vehicle.
But so to be clear then, you support in principle allowing the food trucks to operate downtown.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan. They do a good job.
Okay. In 2001, the city passed a charter amendment that forbade it from offering domestic partner benefits to city employees. Obviously, times have changed. The Supreme Court made its ruling on the Defense of Marriage Act. Now, that's a federal level, but a number of cities and some school boards in Texas have recently passed ordinances granting benefits to same-sex or unmarried partners. If that were to come up again in the city of Houston, would you support an effort to overturn that charter amendment from 2001 and allow the city to offer benefits to domestic partners?
I think I'd be in favor of that. Of course, I'm traditionalist on marriages between a man and a woman, but the domestic partnership, to me, makes sense. If you're in the hospital and your best friend wants to be your caretaker, or your best friend wants to make legal decisions and such like that, I think that should be allowed. So I think in context of domestic partners' benefits, I'd be in favor of it.
Okay. I'm asking everyone I talk to, who do you support for mayor in November?
Well, my campaign manager told me just stay out of everybody's election, but I think the mayor's doing a good job.
Okay. As we sit here and talk today, you don't have any opponents running against you, but of course the filing deadline's still a ways away, so anything can happen. But when people do go to vote this November, whether you're opposed or not, why should they vote to give you a second term on city council?
Good question. I think the same way I handled three terms on the local school board, three terms on the state board of education, I feel very confident if your focus is correct for helping either the taxpayer, the student, or the teacher, and you do your homework, the voters will reelect you. So I'm just I don't think about politics that often. I had to think about it to get elected because it was very difficult in a big city to beat, let's say, an incumbent. It was just very difficult, so I had to focus there. But my focus is more on public service instead of the politics.
Okay. Councilmember Jack Christie, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Good questions.